UK Wine Show, show number 27, Mount Difficulty. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 27 for the 1st of December. This week I'm going to be interviewing Michael Herrick from Mount Difficulty. We're going to talk to Michael about the grape varieties that have been growing in Otago and what they've learnt, what grapes have managed to last the course as they've experimented with various grape varieties, and what's been pulled out. We're going to be talking to him also about some of the unique characteristics of Otago, how some of the local plant life can express themselves in the wine. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Shoppers hoping to buy cut-price alcohol from other European countries via the internet were disappointed last week. Judges in Luxembourg ruled that the tax laws which have benefited British cross-channel customers won't be extended to internet purchases. The European Court of Justice overturned an earlier opinion by the Advocate General, allowing people to order alcohol online and pay the lower duty of other member states. The case came as a result of a group of Dutch wine drinkers who regularly went to France to buy wine. They went to court complaining that after paying French duty, they then paid more tax to import into the Netherlands. The judges ruled that products must be transported personally by the individual who purchased them. This put paid to British drinkers' hopes for huge savings on their bottles without leaving home. Currently, a bottle of wine coming to Britain from France is taxed at £1.29, whereas French tax on a bottle is less than 2 pence. All is not lost, as wine drinkers can still enjoy plenty of cheaper taxed wine for the cost of a trip across the Channel. The guidelines allow one person to bring back 90 litres. Meanwhile, Oddbins have been quick to respond to the ruling by offering a free return day trip to booze cruisers who want to stock up before Christmas. To take advantage of the offer, customers must spend £200 at Oddbins Wine and Beer Superstore in Calais, ordering what they want before they go. The free crossing allows for a car and up to 4 passengers. There is also a free short break return ferry trip valid for 3 days for those spending over £300. And finally, a team in the US is conducting research into the diversity of the Zinfandel grape. The project, called the Zinfandel Heritage Vineyard, is a partnership between UC Davis and ZAP, the Zinfandel Advocates and Producers. ZAP is the organisation dedicated to advancing the knowledge and appreciation for American Zinfandel. They began their Zinfandel safaris in the early 1990s, looking for diversity within the grape variety among 100-year-old vineyards in California. They collected about 80 selections from 40 vineyards in 16 counties. These were then planted in the Napa Valley. Joel Peterson from Ravenswood Wines, the biggest producer of Zinfandel in the US and also a member of ZAP, told us the selections have already been narrowed down to 20 very interesting variations. The team is in the process of making wines from the selections, but they have at least 3 to 5 more vintages ahead before they can confidently release a superior selection. The aim of the project is to give producers the clonal knowledge to plant better Zinfandel in the future. That's all for the news this week. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers for that, Jane. I suppose even if the European Court won't let us import cheap wine from Europe at low duties, at least Oddbins have given us the opportunity to cruise over to France and have some cheap plonk for Christmas. Up to 10 cases are allowed back into the country, so that's a fair amount. Next, we're going to have the interview with Michael. Hi, I'm here with Michael Herrick from Mount Difficulty Wines in central Otago. How are you, Michael?
Very well, thanks, Chris.
First of all, you're the marketing manager at Mount Difficulty, but how did you get into the trade?
I got back involved in the wine industry back in the late 90s, really. I was travelling through Australia, and my first job as I was coming from Sydney was working in a vineyard pruning grapevines, trying to get enough money to...
Winter pruning. Oh, I've done that. I've done it in the winter, and it's awful.
It's a job. It's quite hard work, and... it does give you the grassroots of viticulture, but it ignited my flame for wine. I met a load of interesting people in the industry and decided, this is fantastic, however, I don't want to be pruning, so what do? And they pointed me in the direction of Roseworthy, so I enrolled there, and 6 months later, studied. And after graduation, worked with a company in McLaren Vale, Wirra Wirra Wines, And then from there, I went to the south of France to do a couple of vintages. From there, worked in the UK, learning more about like the coalface of wine sales in a company called Oddbins. And then I worked for a distributor. And after that, came home and worked for New Zealand's largest winery, Montana. Mm-hmm. And 3 years ago, joined Mount Difficulty Wines in Central Otago because it was a chance to get close to my passion, which is Pinot Noir. And a place that's close to my heart is Central Otago, as I used to spend a lot of time there as a child on holidays.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic part of the world.
So you've been with Mount Difficulty now for 3 years. How did Mount Difficulty start?
Well, the region of Bannockburn was pretty much started by a group of like-minded locals, either businessmen or farmers. Back in 1992, Mount Difficulty planted most of their grapes. And in the early stages, just sold. It was all about viticulture, and they sold grapes to local producers. And it soon became quite apparent that the quality was outstanding and the results were terrific. So they made the move to pool the resources of five different vineyards in the region to join and create Mount Difficulty Wines and create their own label, and in 1998 made the first wine. And in those days it was just Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and those are the two grapes grown. And since then we've experimented with different varieties, and we now trial Rieslings, Pinot Gris, even a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc, but still predominantly Pinot Noir.
You used to have a wee bit of Gewürz Traminer. Do you still do that?
Unfortunately not any longer. Gewürz, I think, is well suited to the region. It just loves that cooler climate, and the likes of its home, natural home, being Alsace. I think it's a very similar environment for Gewürz. However, we had the wrong clone at the time. There are other producers in the region still producing Gewürz, and they do a superb job. You know, lots of aromatics, lots of spiciness. But we've since pulled it all out. We've found we're having amazing results with Pinot Gris. So for us, that's really the white wine that we're having.
Pinot Gris is quite trendy in New Zealand at the moment. I know you get a lot of domestic sales. I've never been a huge fan of New Zealand Pinot Gris. I think it's a bit wishy-washy. How are you guys finding it? You know, is it being exported or is it mainly domestic consumption?
Well, we sell roughly 50% of our total production domestically, but we're quite excited about the future of Pinot Gris. I think valid points, what you're saying about Pinot Gris in New Zealand could be a little insipid perhaps, but I think that's more to do with it's finding its feet. It's a relatively new grape variety there, and it's about finding the sub-regions and regions that it suits, as well as viticulture that best suits that area, as well as the wine styles for the winemakers, mm-hmm. and their interpretation of the grape. So I believe it's just an evolution. So given time, we're pretty excited about it. In fact, Central Otago, for me, I think is probably one of the best-suited regions for a more Alsatian style, all about the aromatics, all about a reflection of the regionality and the natural fruit. In fact, it's one of our least winemaker-influenced wines. It's just basically all about the aromatics, all about the fruit. It's left in stainless steel and minimal intervention. And we get lovely, spicy pear and nectarine and all sorts of interesting stuff coming out of it. But it seems to suit Asian fusion, Pacific Rim food extremely well. Yeah, and I think that's why the growth in popularity, in fact, it grew in New Zealand about 150% last year alone. Yeah. Admittedly off a small base, but I feel that popularity is spreading to Australia, and we're finding also in the UK and America they can't get enough of it.
Yeah, Pinot Gris in the UK is dead trendy at the moment, Pinot Gris, Pinot Grigio. You used to grow a bit of Merlot. You've pulled that out. What was the story there?
No, Merlot is very much about trial and error. Because the region's so young and new, it's a matter of taking an educated guess on what works. And our early founders have a passion for that grape, but we found that it did give us lovely quality wine. Unfortunately, the consistency in cropping was an issue. So we've now made the choice to remove that and actually replace it with the Pinot Gris.
So it was low cropping levels or...?
Extremely low cropping levels. The quality was outstanding, but you had, at fruit set, a lot of hen and chicken. And because Central Otago's...
What do you mean by hen and chicken?
Hen and chicken is a case where, at flowering, the potential grape set doesn't necessarily ripen all of the berries or doesn't fertilize every berry. So you might have 30% of the bunch flowering and ripening and becoming a berry, whereas the remainder of the bunch may stay as hard bullets or berry shatter.
Yeah.
Or they may actually flower later in the season. So you've got some greener style berries happening at the same time as the nice fleshy ripe ones. So
you're getting good fruit, but you're getting all sorts of stuff mixed in there.
And also the levels of cropping are down significantly. In fact, as an example, last year we had exceptional fruit quality, but unfortunately we worked out the economics of making each bottle. We were losing about $30 each bottle sold.
Okay.
So it didn't make any good sense to continue with Merlot.
Don't have to be a brain surgeon to give it up.
It was a no-brainer. And to be honest, Pinot Noir loves the region.
Yeah.
It's its natural home, or it seems to be its second natural home.
Pinot Noir is the big grape variety down Otago ways, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How much do you think is planted in Otago versus other varieties?
Obviously, Pinot Noir is the founding grape variety of the region, and it's up to 85% of the total region is now Pinot Noir.
Your Pinot Noirs, you guys do three quality levels. What are they?
Mount Difficulty was founded on our Mount Difficulty Estate Pinot Noir, so that's still the main focus and is the most important of our three Pinots. But as the region develops, we're beginning to find little regions and sub-regions that give you special results, and as a result of that, we've gives us an opportunity to diversify. So we now have three levels. Our entry level, if you like, Pinot Noir, is the Roaring Meg, and it's very much made to a more fruit-driven style, and much more about the pretty fruit aromatics, and that typical reflects the typical dark cherry that you get from the Bannockburn region. But it's much more approachable young. So it's really hoping to introduce people not only to Pinot Noir, but also to that part of the world and New Zealand and Central Otago Pinot Noir. Then you take the step into our estate, which is really what it's all about. It's all the bells and whistles, and the cropping levels are less than half. So you go from 4.5 tonnes per acre down to 2.5. And it also allows that there's more concentration.
Yep.
It also allows a greater use of French barrique. So we can age it in an oak for up to 12 months versus 9 months for the Roaring Meg. It also means we can use a little bit of toasting, and we can also use a higher proportion of new oak. And then finally, the ultimate reflection of terroir, which is it's all about the sub-region of Bannockburn, not only the sub-region, just one particular vineyard, and that's our single vineyard series. It's a wine that's not necessarily made every year, but in years that are good enough, we get some really exciting results. It's nice to keep that aside. And if we get a year good enough, we'll never make more than 400 cases, but it's a chance for us to sort of show the opportunities that do exist for parts of Central Otago.
And where do you crop that at?
Cropping levels there, again, we target around a ton per acre. But last year, we did get a single vineyard. It was less than that. It was about 0.89 of a ton. So again, it's all about the concentration of the fruit and the tannin structure. And
those cropping levels are quite low. Like in Europe, we normally use hectolitres per hectare, but one tonne an acre works out to be roughly, 17.5 hectolitres per hectare, which if you compare that to sort of top-end Bordeaux, which is normally at about 30 hectolitres per hectare, you're cropping almost half of what the top-end Chateaus in Bordeaux are doing, so you're getting lots of concentration there.
That's right, and I guess that's a reflection of the climate of Central Otago. Because we're so far south, we sit below the 42nd parallel, it does mean we're on a razor's edge.
You mean 42 degrees latitude below 42nd parallel, yeah?
Yeah, and it means we're really on the edge of what's possible viticulturally. So it's about the microclimate, and if you overcrop these vines, you just aren't going to get the results.
They're not going to ripen?
They will probably ripen, but you won't get the concentration. You won't get the reflection of that vibrant, dark cherry, bright fruit that seems so popular for the Central Otago region. And again, you may have ripening problems, particularly in the cooler years.
Talked about the terroir for your single vineyards, but don't you just plant on the old sluicing? You know, Otago used to be a big gold rush.
Well, back then the gold miners have it's fascinating. They've literally removed, in some cases, the whole side of the mountain, and a whole plateau of hillside through the Bannockburn region is pretty much gone from the sluicings and the gold miners. And what's remained is a few piles of stones, and that's about it. And ironically, it's now all protected, so you can't actually touch the sluicings themselves. But where we're planted, is a lot of our vineyards are in the north-facing slopes in front of the sluicings, and are planted on a lot of the sluicings wash. So we've got interesting soil types that are part made through old ancient glacier beds, and then part man-made soils with a lot of fine alluvial silts with shingle and then washed over clays from the man-made sluicing. So there's some quite diverse soil types, and as a result use a selection of many different clones, and keep those clones separated all the way through picking, hand picking, fermentation and maturation. And really that allows us to keep track on which clones are performing best in which soil types, and every year just keep improving that a little.
And that comes through in the aromatics of the wine?
I think so. There's still the debates on what's making or giving more influence to the wine. Is it the clonal selection, or is it the regionality, or is it the soils?
Yeah.
We believe it's more about the regionality in the soils at this point.
What about things like, I know in Australia when they have bushfires, the smoke gets into the wine and you get smoky flavour into the wine, or eucalyptus is another example. If you've got eucalyptus trees nearby. My nana used to take me for big long walks through central Otago, and the place just reeks of thyme. Do you get that sort of thing coming as an expression through the wines as well?
Yes, very much. It's thyme is one of my favourite herbs, but it was introduced to the region back in the 1860s with the gold miners. I believe the story goes that the Italian gold miners brought it across with them, Timo. So it went well with quite a lot of wild rabbit in those days. And as a result, it grows everywhere on the side of the hills. And you're right, you go walking through there and it just, the wafts of fresh thyme as you're stepping through it, it's incredible. And the aromatics can't help but be influence some of the grapes that we have. For example, a Pinot Gris growing right on the side of a bank with the prevailing wind being the northwest. Every summer it blows a lot of the flowering thyme flavours through the vineyard, and we get quite a distinct herbal character and herbal note of thyme coming through in those wines. It's also reflected, and I see in a lot of Pinot Noirs, a lot of wine writers' tasting notes, you'll see a referral to a nice herbal note or character in the wine. Dried herb, thyme character, and I believe that's where it comes from.
Okay, excellent. What about frosts? Bannockburn's got its own wee microclimate. Do you get much in the way of frosts down there?
Again, Central Otago, because we are on that razor's edge, we are fairly vulnerable to frosts. And most years you can expect it. I guess one in three you'd expect to get away without a frost. So you're more likely to get a frost than not. And as a result, all the viticulturists take varying measures against it. And some are helicopters. You can basically hover helicopters over your vineyards.
Gosh, that must be expensive.
At the cost of around $1,200 an hour.
New Zealand dollars an hour. £5,000. £500.
Not to mention the call-out fee.
Yeah.
And they can be hovering anywhere from midnight through till dawn. So you don't want too many frosts per year.
No.
This helps explain why Pinot Noir is so expensive to produce. That's just one side of it.
Yeah, and the low cropping levels we touched on earlier is probably another reason.
Absolutely.
What about, is there any other methods of managing the frost?
Well, you can use, a man-made version of a grounded helicopter, which is a wind machine, and it's like a large pylon that sits in the middle of your vineyard with a large rotor blade and attached to an engine. So that sits in the vineyard and is connected by computer to a temperature control, and as soon as your vineyards drop to zero or close to zero, they start up the engines. And that acts in very much the same manner as a helicopter. It basically pushes the warm air and inversion layer down to the fruiting wire, and hopefully if there is a warm air inversion layer, will stop your buds from freezing and hopefully save your vineyards. There is another form used. It's called flippers or water spraying, and the idea is there. You have a water flipper sitting along the trellis on top of your vineyard, and should the temperature drop significantly, that'll spring into action and pump an enormous amount of water over your vines throughout the frost. And what that does is it acts in the same way as a refrigerator works. As the water freezes over the buds or the berries in the vine, it lets off heat, and it's generating heat, obviously protects the buds from freezing solid. And also, once the buds are cocooned in ice, it acts like an igloo, meaning that your temperature won't drop below 0 degrees.
Within the bud.
So outside the bud, it's still freezing, and water is freezing on layers upon layers,
yep.
While inside it's snug and safe in its cocoon of ice.
Why don't people do that as a general rule? It sounds like spraying a bit of water. There's lots of water around central Otago. Why don't people just do that all the time?
There's a number of reasons. There isn't necessarily a lot of water available around central Otago is one. So you have to have access to a substantial amount of water rights.
Yeah.
It's not, when we say water, the difference between a small amount of water you need, or relatively small amount for irrigation, compared to flipper spraying, it needs large volumes of water. So you need access to a large reservoir.
Okay.
That's one reason. The other is it's not suitable for all vineyard types. You need very free-draining soil. And if you don't, your vineyard can quickly turn into a quagmire and bog. Yep. And the other problem is the nature of frost. It tends to come close to when you want to pick. So if you get too much water absorption through the vines and sure. berries swell, and water down your fruit characteristics, or worst case, they burst. And again, you get maybe bacterial infection to the wine.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Michael. Thanks very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me along.
Not a problem. Cheers very much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Michael Herrick from Mount Difficulty. Quite a nice bloke. Next week, we're going to start our two-part series, Getting Ready for Christmas. We're going to be talking to Matthew Jukes, who's the wine writer for the Daily Mail. According to Matthew, it's one of the largest wine columns read in the UK with over 1 million readers. And following that, we're talking to Taylors about port, their ports, and also, since it's getting close to Christmas and that time of year, how to drink port and get the most out of your bottle of port for Christmas. So until then, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jartel and Silence by Etoile Noire.